I love academic institutions. You get applause for just showing up. It's fantastic. I am very, very, very pleased to be here. I have some roots here, actually. I've done both touristing and work around here going back decades. I love Monterey. I've got some friends here in the audience. Chief Kelly McMillan from the Salinas Police Department's here. And when Kelly got this rolling and said Cal State might be interested in doing this, I leapt at it. I've had a number of very interesting conversations already during the day. Dr. Ochoa and the administration and the faculty have been wonderful hosts. So, also, it's warm. It's so nice. And that's about the last pleasant thing I'm going to say for the next hour or so, I can tell you. This is nasty stuff that we are here to talk about. Dr. Ochoa said, I wrote this book called Don't Shoot a couple of years ago. I am an academic. I'm a professor of criminal justice at John Jay in New York. I have done all the academic writing. We're serious about what we do. We do research. We do theory. We do evaluations. We publish. I have a very academic version of this sort of same stuff we're going to be talking about, which came out some years before Don't Shoot did. It has the best-selling title of Deterrence and Crime Prevention, Reconsidering the Prospect of Sanction. And it's been out for over 10 years. I think the last time I checked, there were 5 reviews on Amazon. 2 of them were from people I know. And one of them said, this is probably a really good book, but it's really expensive, so I'm not going to buy or read it. So this academic approach was definitely not working to get out what I consider to be very, very important stuff. So Don't Shoot is not that kind of a book, and it is essentially a 250-60 page rant about these issues. And fundamentally, it only says 2 things. It says it is much, much worse out there than nearly anybody who is not in the thick of it can believe. And we know enough now to do much better. And I'm going to explore those themes today. I work in the most dangerous places in the United States. We all know, if you're paying any attention to these issues at all, that crime has been coming down in the United States for about 20 years. It is a signal national success. At the national level, these aren't even issues any longer. When I started doing this stuff in the mid-1980s, in the middle of the crack epidemic, White House was talking about it, Congress was talking about it, passing bills, rewriting our federal laws. Everybody was focused on this. I watched, I think, everything in the last presidential campaign. There were essentially no mentions of this issue whatsoever. And that is because everybody knows it has gotten so much better. And mostly we look on the national level to the FBI to report this. Every fall there's a headline in everybody's paper saying FBI has released the Uniform Crime Report numbers for the last calendar year and violent crime is a little bit up or a little bit down. And almost without fail over the last 20 years, that headline has said down, 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 down. And that is correct. If there is one thing in criminal justice we are really good at, it is counting dead people. And so if you're looking at those homicide numbers, they are reliable, and they have indeed been steadily, steadily declining. So that is true, and for many, many, many of us in this wonderful country of ours, it is entirely beside the point. Because if you live in Black America, and if you live especially in poor Black America, it is not true. Things are better than they were at the worst of the crack years. Most places, that's right. They are unconscionably bad. So the national homicide rate has now come down to about 4 per 100,000. This is the way criminologists and the FBI track things, meaning 4 killed per 100,000 population every single year. I'm going to mention one of my colleagues a couple of times today. His name is John Klofas, and he is a criminologist at the Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York. And if you are a young Black man in what's called the Crescent in Rochester, and this is an arc of very troubled neighborhoods around downtown Rochester, if you are a young Black man in that set of neighborhoods, you are dying at a rate of over 500 per 100,000 every single year. And for every actual killing, there are 5, 6, 7 non-fatal gunshot wounds. These are neighborhoods of walkers and wheelchairs and colostomy bags. And over some years, if you just do the math, almost everybody gets hurt. And as we'll see, that's not right either, because this is tremendously unevenly concentrated even by these neighborhoods. But it's up there on the screen. 6% of the population, and essentially half of the homicide victims. And I struggle to communicate this to people. The numbers do not get it across. These are neighborhoods where being killed, being shot, being stabbed, having bullets come through your windows is normal. In Rochester, I worked with a Black woman named Loretta Scott. She was the head of Rochester's Parks and Recreation Department, but she was also a grandmother. And when we were working together, she came to our meeting beside herself one day. Over the previous weekend, she had been heading out of the house to attend the funeral of a neighborhood elder. This was an old Black man who had passed. And she was in the kitchen, and her 6-year-old granddaughter looked at her because she was all dressed in her Sunday finery and said, "Grandma, where are you going?" And she said, "I'm going to so-and-so's funeral." And her 6-year-old granddaughter looked at her and said, "Oh, who killed him?" Not what happened, not what did he die of, who killed him? Because that is what she experiences as normal. I was in Oakland, not far away from here, not that long ago, talking with a homicide investigator, and he had just had a case in which there had been a car-to-car shooting. 2 cars out on the Oakland overpass. People recognize each other. They've got beef. They've got vendetta. 1 car shoots at the other car. Driver in the 2nd car is killed, and his 16-year-old friend in the passenger seat survives both the shooting and the crash. So my homicide investigator friend was trying to clear the case. Kid knew who shot him, wasn't giving him up. And after banging on him for about an hour, my guy finally gave up and just became human and said, "I'm really, really sorry about what happened to your friend." And this stony 16-year-old gangbanger broke down completely, hysterically weeping, and finally got his composure back enough to speak. And he said to the cop, "At least he had a full life." His friend was 21 years old. and by his standards, living that long was an achievement. There are communities all over the country where this is normal, and it is obscene, it is un-American, it is inexcusable. There turns out to be a fact about the violence on the ground on which much of the now effective work is being based. There are things that work out there, and I'm going to sketch them in a minute. When I started doing this in the mid-1980s, everybody knew there was nothing you could do about homicide, and they were right. Nothing anybody was doing was working. Law enforcement didn't work. The social programs didn't work. Community investment didn't work. Nothing worked. That's not true anymore. And almost everything that is turning out to be the most effective is based on what you see up here. Anywhere you find this kind of violence, you find in the community gangs, drug crews, posses, little neighborhood sets, whatever you want to call them. They are groups of exceptionally active street offenders. There are not very many of them in any city. So I'll show you some math on this in a minute. We and others will now systematically audit an entire city for these groups. When you find them, when you add them all up together, everybody in them is going to be under 0.5% of the city's population. And in every city where anybody has ever done this work, that 0.5% is connected with 50, 60, 75% of all the homicide in that city. This is the most lopsided public safety problem you could possibly find. And as a statistical matter, if you do the math and remove from the city the violence associated with these groups, for the most part, these are not violent cities anymore. It is the groups that are driving what we are here talking about. You can do this in any city. This is a network diagram of these groups in Cincinnati a few years ago. This was done by our colleagues at the University of Cincinnati Policing Institute. Each one of these nodes is one of these gangs, crews, drug sets. They have feuds, they have alliances, they beef with each other, they run together. Sometimes they flip back and forth. Some of them, these are the ones up in the upper left-hand corner, they don't have either beef or alliance. As you'll see, there are not very many of them. In most cities, it is this pattern of vendetta that drives the violence. This is very, very, very beefy. Almost all of the violence is not about money. This has been one of the hardest things to get across to the general public, to the politicians. Everybody thinks, right, these guys are dealing drugs, they've got to protect their market, they've got to protect their corner. These are illicit enterprises. Somebody steals your stash or doesn't pay you back, you can't go to the police or the Better Business Bureau. You get your gun and you go deal with it. Perfectly logical, perfectly consistent, and it's not what's going on out there. In, again, essentially every city where anybody has ever looked at this, the piece of this that is actually about making money, including robbing people to make money, is under 20% of what's going on. Everything else is street code nonsense. It's honor culture. If you disrespect me, I have to shoot you. It's the enemy of my friend is my enemy, so you've got beef with my boy, so we've got beef with all your boys. When I was working in San Francisco, the most serious, longest-running feud in the city was in Bayview Hunters Point between Big Block and West Mob, which were actually two reasonably structured crack crews. They weren't shooting each other over the drug business. The best understanding of what we've got about what started it 15 years ago, 10 years ago, with dozens of homicides and God knows how many shootings back and forth, was that it started over who would rap next at a neighborhood block party. And they're still killing each other. And if you think that this is stupid, it's very American. Because in this great country of ours, not all that long ago in the American South, young men of privilege and breeding and enormous Caucasianness went out into the woods at dawn and hacked at each other with sabers, right? That's what dueling was. And they didn't do it because they were black or poor or gang members or crack dealers or came from a single mother family. They had everything going for them. They did it because their honor code said if they didn't, all of their friends would think they were nothing. And so they did it. And this is a young man's game. And this is for all the ladies out there. We all know that there is no stupider organism on the planet than a young man with his friends watching, right? They are not even your ordinary criminal offenders. So this is a criminal history analysis of the individuals represented in that set of Cincinnati groups. They average 35 prior charges apiece. And remember, most of these guys are 21, 22, 23 years old. They have been fantastically busy. And the one that you want to look at is the third one down in the far column on the right. What that says is that essentially a third of everybody in these groups had 10 or more felony priors, even among your criminal population. These guys are exceptional. And this is why this matters. None of the rest of it's academically interesting, but here's why it is important. Those 61 groups in Cincinnati were 0.3% of the city's population. They were connected as victim offender or often both with 3/4 of all killings in Cincinnati. This is Los Angeles. This is the Mission District in the San Fernando Valley. Biggest gang in the Mission is Sanfer, after San Fernando. They go back to the Zoot Suit Riots. They've been there so long. There's also a gang there called the Grumpy Winos, which is my single favorite gang name ever. All the gang members in the Mission District, 0.2% of the city population, over 60% of the homicides. This is how it works. We are in Salinas. This is Salinas. So this has been, I guess the phrase is we've changed the names to protect the guilty in this case. But you have clusters of different groups. They are allied together. Sometimes that's what the red line means. You cannot trust your fellows in this world, and sometimes they're beefing with each other. But this cluster is fighting with this cluster. You've got all these others that are kind of off on their own, but they're beefing with each other. This is what is going on in Salinas. And at the time this work began in Salinas, which I will come back to later on, this is 5-6 years ago, I think. The city had had a record homicide year. I believe there were 28 homicide victims that year. Every single one of them was a gang homicide. This and the previous this and the next was done by our very good friends and partners out of Stuart Wakeling's shop up in the Bay Area, the California Partnership for Safe Communities. They've been supporting Salinas in this work. You see exactly the same pattern. So 90%+ of suspects, 60% of victims, prior records. You add this stuff up, the juvenile, the adult, the different offense categories, they're averaging about 10 priors apiece. 60% of the shooters have been on probation. 40% of them have been locked up. Actually, more of the victims have been locked up. This is a university. We get to do pop quizzes. Anybody have any idea why the victims would be more active than the shooters? Bingo. Good for you. The typical pattern nationally on this is that you've got something like a 3 to 5 year age gap with, as you said, shooters tending to shoot older guys. And it's the right-hand number at the top that means the most here. Almost 90% of these killings in Salinas are group involved. And the next one below that is the next most important, which is 60%+ of them. And then if you add the individual rather than the group stuff, 70% of them are continuing hostile relationships. There's almost no making money in here. And that's, again, the way it works. So this is what we now know about the way this works. This is not city specific. You get this anywhere you go. So if you look at that group involved population, it's under 1% of the city. In the most dangerous neighborhoods, it's about 5% of the most active age group. So this is, again, it's a men's game, and basically it's late adolescence to the late 20s where you're the most active. And of that 5% in the most dangerous neighborhoods, it's about 1 in 5 that really drive things, what law enforcement, and we do the same thing now, calls impact players. Hardly anybody is making this happen. And so here is the most astonishing figure that has come out of this, which is, doesn't matter, L.A., Detroit, Chicago, Salinas, Oakland, it's 0.1% of the city's population that is really at the heart of this. And they are dying like flies. So you heard this number before. Average risk in the country now, 4 dead per 100,000. If you are in this highly active group, gang, criminal network, you will be going down at 3,000 per 100,000 every year, 1 in 30 for all practical purposes. And my colleagues have done the math on this. You would, in fact, be far better off serving in the military in Afghanistan on the ground right now than being one of these guys. And even in the network, it's not even, because we now know that if you're running together and one of your guys is shot, if you're socially criminally connected to him, you are about 10 times more likely than even anybody else in this network to get killed over the next little while. A huge amount of what they do because they are scared witless, which makes you carry guns and get crewed up and be hair trigger and all that kind of stuff. All right. Second part of my argument is we don't have to do this anymore. There is a way of intervening that has proven to be not perfect, not by any means, but I said there used to be nothing that worked. Now there's something that makes a big difference. It is this. It goes by various names, done in different ways, but the backbone of it is you put together a partnership of community people, social service providers, and law enforcement. You make the violence your priority. You establish a direct relationship with these guys. They're on probation and parole. You can call them into a meeting. I'll talk about just going out and finding them in the neighborhoods, but you have to talk to them. And when this partnership talks to them, it says, we know who you are. We know what you're doing. This is group stuff. You know it. We know it. We are going to be paying attention to your groups as groups from now on. if one of your guys shoots somebody, we're not just going to stop with that shooting. You guys have been shooting each other back and forth for 20 years. We are going to pay attention to the group. We want you alive. We want you out of prison. We would like to help you. Your community is going to tell you that they cannot stand the violence and they need it to stop. They care about you and they want you in the community in your rightful place. And we are not asking, this is not a negotiation. So when you leave here, we will, for example, wait for the next body to fall. And whatever group did that killing, yes, we will try to arrest the shooter and go get them, but we will also look at any and all crimes anybody in the group is committing. And the price to the group may be, for example, that we slide in the drug undercovers, and while we're prosecuting the shooter for the homicide, all other 19 guys in his set are going to go to jail on selling drugs on the corner. We're telling you ahead of time because we don't want to do it. We just want the shooting to stop. And now it's up to you. So normally at this point in my public speaking on this, I would go into a lot of detail about how we do this. Today I'm not going to do that because we now know that if you do this, you will get ordinarily really dramatic results. These are all outcomes from formal evaluations of these approaches in different places. For those of you who do methods, there isn't anything in this roster that is less than a quasi-experimental peer-reviewed evaluation. We have very good confidence that this is actually telling us that something real is going on. And within this, there is some kind of amazing stuff. So this one in the middle that says 34% reduction in homicide, that's a citywide result. In Indianapolis, there were five concentrated areas of homicide victimization. They were all poor black neighborhoods. And in those neighborhoods, the reduction in black male homicide victimization was 70%. This is a big deal. We've been doing it long enough now, and we understand it well enough to begin to think about what this tells us about the way we should think about public safety. And that is what I want to talk about today. I spend a lot of time thinking about how doctors do things. I work, not that many anymore, but I work with police chiefs, for example, who will say to you, We don't have any more dead people this year than we did last year, so I don't really have a problem. I'm doing okay. You would never hear a doctor say that. Doctors say, I don't care how well I'm doing, we're going to do better. And they stick at it, and over time, they tend to get it right. So I have been asking myself the question, and it's the title of this talk, what if criminal justice had a Hippocratic oath? Because we don't. And we are getting to the point in this where something that serves that purpose is actually beginning to emerge. And that is what I want to dwell on today. I want to talk about that direction. So everybody knows that in the Hippocratic Oath, there is the first rule, first do no harm. Turns out everybody's wrong. I thought it said that, and then I actually started doing my research, and it turns out that in none of the many versions of the Hippocratic Oath does this line actually show up. It says things like, thou shalt administer no deadly drug, and other things that mean this, but the line everybody knows isn't there. This is my Hippocratic Oath, so it's in my Hippocratic Oath. And what this means in medicine is doctors recognize that chemotherapy, for example, is strong medicine. And if you have cancer, it can save your life. But while you are getting chemotherapy, you are likely to be very sick. And if it's done too much or badly or for the wrong reasons, it will kill you. A lot of law enforcement is like chemotherapy. And one of the things that we have come to understand is that in our pursuit of protecting vulnerable neighborhoods, we have actually done a lot of damage. And one of the ways we have done this is by locking up all the men in the neighborhoods. And I am not exaggerating. I work in neighborhoods where essentially all of the men have criminal records. Some of it's for serious stuff, yes, you know, shot people, carrying weapons, all that sort of stuff. Some of it is for not nearly so serious stuff, like getting caught walking down the street with a joint in their pocket while the cops stop them. Anybody here ever walked around campus with a joint in their pocket? Anybody really worried about getting arrested on this campus? Right? These places don't get the same treatment that other places do. And it is not because the cops are racist. It is because there is violence there, and police and everybody else have been doing what they can to prevent the violence. But what it has meant is we have grown. When I started this stuff in the early 1980s, there were about 300,000 people in prison. Anybody know what the number is now? 2.3 million people behind bars in this country. And these places are still out of control dangerous, so it has not worked. What we know about the impact of what we're calling mass incarceration on these neighborhoods, it's growing pretty much every day, and every little bit of detail that's added to it is making it more awful. These men will statistically never get a good job. There's no reason for them to go back to school. Their degrees won't mean anything. They can't get bonded. They can't pass a background check. They are less likely to marry. They are less likely to support their existing families. Their kids are more likely to go to prison and fail school. If you do not have a parent in prison, about 5% of kids get expelled from school. If you have a parent in prison, 25% of kids get expelled from school. It just goes on and on and on and on. And one of the things that we now know is that there is a community-level impact, which is that if too many people have had bad experiences with law enforcement, have gone to jail, have gone to prison, people are less likely to work with the police. They won't report. They won't bear witness. They won't convict on juries. Stop snitching. I get a lot of calls from media saying, we want to talk about stop snitching. Tell us about witness intimidation. And I say to them, and almost none of them listen, stop snitching is not about fear. For the most part, people are not afraid. They are angry. They want nothing to do with the police. And the norm in these neighborhoods has become good people don't talk to the police. They're not afraid. They are withdrawing. They are less likely to do the things that healthy communities do to prevent crime. They are less likely when they see guys standing on the corner selling drugs to passing cars with guns in their pocket. Don't do that. Get yourself home. They are less likely to control their neighbor's kids, all the things that healthy cultures do. People will not work for and stand up with people from the outside that they see as destructive enemies. And once again, because the crime is there, the violence is there. In Baltimore, where they did the study, if you were a 20 to 30-year-old black male, on any given day, half of everybody was under criminal supervision, not had a criminal record, under court supervision. They were in prison, in jail, on parole, or on probation. and 20% of all the black males 20 to 30 were locked up on any given day. And the community does not like this. We should stop treating people abusively when we stop them in those neighborhoods in the name of protecting them. This is a quote from a wonderful ethnographic piece of research on young black men in St. Louis. Rod Brunson is an ethnographer now at Rutgers University in New Jersey. The quote that is the title of the article is a direct quote from one of the young black men who, when asked what he thought about the police, said to Rod, "The police don't like black people." That was his understanding of what was going on out there. And Rod's summation of this was, the neighborhood thinks that the cops send the worst people to the neighborhood to mess with as many people as they possibly can. And they don't like it. We should stop lying to people. The one with the one gun will get you five quote is from a federal project called Operation or Project Exile. And in cities all over the country, the feds are handing out these little business cards. They've got late night public service announcements. There are posters on the sides of buses. And it says, one gun will get you five, which means under the federal gun laws, if you're caught with a gun, you will get 5 years in federal prison. Guess what? It's not true. And if you work with the feds, you know that they will, what they call adopt, they will actually take very few cases. Most of the gun cases will never go federal. They get handled ordinarily by state prosecutors. My friend John Clofus, again, has been interviewing guys in Rochester about Project Exile. And what they say is, they're lying to us. We all know people who got picked up with guns. They didn't go federal. And I know this guy who did get picked up with a gun, and he did go federal. And that's because the racist cops took him out personally. If you know the federal law, it's not like that. There are all kinds of prosecutorial reasons. There's prosecutorial discretion. There are the caseload issues. The federal judges don't want to see these cases. They want to send your mayor to prison. They don't want to hear this stuff. All these reasons that the feds don't, in fact, take every case. The streets don't know that. The streets just know that, once again, what came out of our mouth is fraudulent. The feds, the National Department of Transportation, is spreading this rumor. Anybody who watches TV has seen these awful public service announcements of guys opening their car doors and it's filled with beer and all the beer drains out on the floor. And there's a state trooper there and there's this awful tagline. The research says even chronic alcoholics will drive thousands of times and never even get stopped, much less go to jail. And just like the gun stuff, the people who know the most that this is nonsense are the ones who do it the most, who we want to persuade not to do it. In the formal deterrence literature, this is what the scholars have called the experiential effect. And what it means is the more you do crime, the more you know you can get away with it, because that's the way it usually works. Anybody here walked across campus with a joint in their pocket? And the more you know that when the authorities try to get your attention by scaring you, my friend George Kellen calls this woofing. We got to stop lying to people. So, after we first do no harm, what should we do? Well, the next thing we should do most of the time is try to help communities to control themselves. Show of hands, please. Growing up here, who was really afraid of the cops? Thanks. Hardly anybody. When you were growing up, who was really afraid of your mother? This is everything you will ever need to know about what scholarship calls informal social control. And what we know about this is that informal social control is way more powerful than formal social control. Good communities take care of themselves, and then they are able to call on the cops when they need help. And the most powerful thing we can do a lot of the time is help communities do that. This one's really weird. And it is that the one thing the left and the right can agree upon is that we shouldn't act like this. Right? Liberals think we shouldn't blame victims. Conservatives think these guys are a lost cause and there's no reason to talk to them. The one thing they won't do is say, you're a grown-up and you're a citizen and you should do the right thing. We know better than that. We know that most of these guys are not psychopaths. You can, in fact, treat them as responsible. And they should and often will stand up to that. So this is what we call in our work the community moral voice. It is finding people that these guys respect and creating circumstances in which those people can say to them, there's right, there's wrong, we expect you to behave accordingly. You are a member of this community, there are things you do and don't do in this community. And I've seen this over and over and over again. My single favorite moment here was an OG, an original gangster in North Carolina, standing in front of a room full of drug dealers, saying to them, look, I was you. I had thug love on the street. I had my family. I loved that. I knew my boys would always be there for me, which is why when the feds came calling, they trampled me to give me up, and why they skated, and why I just came out of my long federal bid. Nobody visited me the whole time I was there. Nobody paid my mother's mortgage. Some other guy raised my daughter, and he looked out at them and said, and how long do you think it will take one of your boys to sleep with your girlfriend? And this kid raised his hand and he said, 3 days, and it was my cousin. They know this, but nobody ever says the emperor's got no clothes. So this is really powerful. We get back to hardly anybody in the neighborhood is doing this. In the most dangerous neighborhood in Cincinnati, we helped figure out how to do something we call custom notifications. You find the impact players, you find people who know them, you go out, you make the contact, you have this conversation with them. You see this right here. 10 homicides in 29. 7 in 2010, 11 in 2011. They made contact with 6 of these guys in the neighborhood, and they didn't have a homicide for 18 months. Nobody got arrested, nobody went to jail, communities in front, that's what we want. That's not always going to work. So when it doesn't work, what do we want to do? We want to get to a point where people do the right thing because they have respect for the law. This is what, again, the social scientists call legitimacy. It is the belief of the public that the law and especially the police are acting rightly, justly, fairly, in their own best interest, and out of genuine respect for the community. Law enforcement writes these neighborhoods off. I cannot tell you how many times I have heard cops, you can read this in the paper, say, in these neighborhoods, guns have become the preferred method of dispute resolution. No, they haven't. If that were right, there would literally be nobody left standing. Even most of the most violent people hardly ever take advantage of their opportunities for violence. And on the other hand, the very first time I interviewed a gang member in 1995 in Boston, in my first interview with him, unprovoked, he said to me, killing people is wrong. He knew that. I'll talk about a call in one of these conversations in Chattanooga later on. One of the ministers was speaking to the group, and he said, "Scripture says, thou shalt not kill." And the dirtiest, angriest, most resentful guy in those chairs, I watched him, and he nodded along with that, right? We want people to do the right thing because they have respect for those civic institutions. This is not about outcomes. It's not about whether things go well. It's about whether people are treated right. And what we now know is there is a direct link to violent crime. Legitimacy goes down, violent crime goes up. And I keep talking about these guys, the beefs, all this stuff. If you know who killed your friend, you have two perfectly substitutable choices. You can tell the police, you can work with the prosecutors, you can testify, and you can send the guy to prison. Or you can get a gun in your friends and go kill him. And where people don't trust the police, we're getting door number two. We want door number one. At which point, it becomes relevant that for most of their history, in fact, under the Constitution of, I keep saying it, these great United States, the police were and are in a formal, legally supported conspiracy to do the community damage, right? That is what racism is. It's what Jim Crow was. It's what the black codes were. Informally, it's what lynching was. Everybody in these neighborhoods has memories and stories about the FBI going after Martin Luther King and the dogs and the fire hoses being set on the civil rights marchers. They've all had their own ugly experience with the police, and they don't like it. And in the worst of circumstances, they have a narrative that says what is going on now, the violence, the drugs, the guns, is not happening in the neighborhood by accident. It is happening because the police and everybody else want it to happen. Somebody here must have read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Brilliant book. It is a civil rights lawyer's book-length argument that mass incarceration and especially drug enforcement is the continuation of Jim Crow by other legal means. And there are lots of people who believe it. And law enforcement sees this anger and sees this silence and sees that the community will not talk about who's killing their own kids and will not snitch and will not bear witness and says, they like it like this. They want it like this, which is a blood libel. Nobody likes living like this. But the community looks at the police and sees corruption, and the police look at the community and see corruption. And we have to do better than this. So this is our Attorney General, Eric Holder, speaking to the assembled nation's police chiefs last fall in Philadelphia, saying, as the nation's chief law enforcement officer, fixing this and getting legitimacy right is the most important thing we can do. And we need to work with communities so that they are lawful, not because they're terrified, but because they respect us and they do not respect us. This is a lot easier to work on than people think. So we are working in neighborhoods all over the country where police are going to the communities and saying, we get it. We have messed up. It hasn't worked. We have been stepping into awful traditions. We didn't do that to you then, but we're kind of acting in that same genealogy. We want to do this differently, but we can only do it. Nobody can set standards for your community from the outside. If the only people saying to the 5%, put your guns down, are outsiders in uniform, we can't make that work. You have to do it. And the idea that the superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, Gary McCarthy, would be saying in public what he is saying in public now. This is a direct quote from Gary, speaking in some of the most angry black neighborhoods in Chicago, that he would be saying this would have been unimaginable to me 5 years ago. But the top people in law enforcement are getting it. They are getting that power without justice and respect is just brutality, and that brutalized neighborhoods will never comply except out of pure terror. And we cannot terrorize some of the most important neighborhoods we've got. All right, I'm running long. I'm going to move through this next bit quickly. When that doesn't work, right, when community standards, when legitimacy doesn't work, we want to get people to comply without actually having to lay hands on them and put them in prison. This is deterrence, right? Enforcement is sticking the guy in a federal prison cell. Deterrence is sitting down with him and saying, you do that again, I'm going to put you in a federal prison cell, and getting his attention and making it work. We know more about this than just about anything else right now. We can call these guys in and say, first gang that kills somebody, we're going after everybody, and everybody gets it, and nobody wants to be that first gang. We can go find the six most dangerous people in the neighborhood, sit down with them, spell this out. It's turning out that simply giving the warning, Anthony Braga at Rutgers has research out of Boston now, you go to the gang, you say everybody's watching you, there better not be any more gunfire. It turns out that that is almost as effective as actually doing the crackdown. And it's cheap, it's quick, it's easy, it's fast. We're stopping drug markets all over the country by getting the case ready, not arresting the guy, sitting down with him and saying, you're out of the drug business. You don't get to do this anymore. Here's the warrant. All we have to do is sign it. You go to jail. We don't want to do it. We don't want to hurt you. Your community doesn't want it. You go back out to the corner and sell again. No more investigations, nothing. One signature, you're going to jail. And almost everybody complies. South Philadelphia has shut down the entire gang landscape pretty much. And they're doing the traditional criminal justice stuff. But they've also found that when they have to go after a crew, about a third of everybody is living in houses that are pirating both their electricity and their cable TV. And word on the street now is that if one of your guys drops somebody today, you're all going to be sitting in the dark reading comic books by candlelight tomorrow. And people get it. They know they're going to have to explain that to their mother. They don't want it. Guys are walking up to the South Philly gang guys and saying, how do I get off this list? I don't want to be on this list. Get me off this list. This stuff, you know, it's people think it's silly, but it's not. It works. All right. Deterrence isn't always going to work. When we have to actually lock people up, we should be as absolutely economical about it as we possibly can. In policing for generations, making an arrest has been a sign of success. It's how you get judged, right? We ought to think of arrests as one of the most costly things we can do. We want the impact without all that collateral damage. And this is my New York City story. Everybody knows that New York City's been on fire about stop and frisk. Here's the deal. Longest sustained crime decline in United States history. 20 years ago, there were almost 2,500 killings a year in New York City. Last year, there were under 350. The result of which signaled success was the last mayoral election depended on throwing out the people who had driven this policy. Because while the mayor and the NYPD argued that stop and frisk was legal, the city decided it was illegitimate. We need a different way of doing this work. And we now know that we can do this. You don't have to arrest every gang in town. You can sit everybody down and say, don't be the next one to put a body on the ground. You've heard this story. This is reforming institutional probation. Normal deal in probation is you violate 12 times, nothing happens. PO says, young man, don't do that again. He finally hauls you up in front of a judge. You get sent back to prison for the rest of your sentence. There's a guy named Steve Alm in Hawaii who started hearing these cases, and the POs would come up and say, judge, he's incorrigible. I've given him 15 chances. He won't listen. Send him back to jail. And Alm said, he literally said, if I had raised my own kids this way, I'd be homeless, right? In Hawaii Hope, he calls everybody in and says, here's the deal. Every single violation, dirty urine, missed appointment, anything, I'm sending you to jail for a day. Not the rest of your sentence, today for a day. Compliance is up, jail's down, prison's down. Drug, these are meth addicts in Hawaii they started with. People everybody knew couldn't control themselves. They're controlling themselves just fine. So there are all sorts of ways to use the law that isn't going to lead to these horrific community consequences. Social network analysis. When you have to take people out, this is the New Breed's crew in Chicago. They killed people. We went after them. Chicago PD went after them. Normally, what everybody would do would be to try to take every single one of these guys out. Did mathematical social network analysis. Turns out if you take the red guys out, you get this. The organization has fallen apart. It's no longer functioning. You can be very economical with authority. So I'm going to wind up here. This is the point. This is a sampling of last year's results from cities using this approach. This stuff is spreading nationally. Those last two are California cities. This is, again, the California Partnership for Safe Communities working with cities and communities, law enforcement in Oakland and Stockton. The results here are fantastic. Everybody thought Oakland especially was completely out of control. It's not. You can do this stuff. And in Chicago, where this is driving the city's work, it's down. It's down historically. It turns out right now it's down even more than that. Homicide in Chicago as we speak is down to mid-1950s levels. This is what's driving it, and they're making fewer arrests. In my New York City, everybody said when stop and frisk stops, the streets are going to be running red with blood. Well, no, they're not, because NYPD is doing this. They've shifted from rampant stop and frisk to what they call crew cut. It's one of these group-focused strategies. The year before they started crew cut, they made something like 800,000 street stops in New York City. Crew cut, 400 arrests, another 25% reduction in homicide, 50% reduction in youth homicide, and stops are down 80%. We can do this work in a way that is legal, legitimate, more effective, helps us regain our trust with the communities, and helps law enforcement, after decades of cynicism, realize that most everybody in these communities actually wants to live right. And I will stop with this. This is a recent call-in in a city I will not name because this was written by an officer who was participating who did not know I was going to put this on PowerPoint and share it with you. But this really happened. These were about 20 of the most dangerous men in the entire city. The mayor walked out, looked at them, and said, I am your mayor. You are citizens of this city, which I love. I care as much about you as I do about anybody else in this city. I want you alive. I want you out of prison. And everybody here in law enforcement and all these other settings has organized to do that. We want you alive, we want your family alive, we want your friends alive, and we are going to tell you today what we can do to help you do that. And if you don't stop it, we're going to come in. But we're telling you today exactly how we're going to do that because we don't want to have to. And I saw this happen. There were two enormous men in this room. One of them was a gangbanger, and one of them was a cop seconded to the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. And I watched them sit down, eat pizza together, hang out, and then when they left, they walked out the door together. Neither one of those people going into that room would have believed that this would happen. And the bottom line here is what we have been doing does not work, is hugely destructive, and brings out the worst in all sides. And this new way of doing things is more effective, is healing, and lets everybody be their best. And Don't Shoot ends with the premise that if this is true and if we can do it, then we'd better. Thank you.